Welcome to Let Genius Burn, a podcast series about the life and legacy of Louisa May Alcott. I'm Jamie Burgess.
And I'm Jill Fuller.
And today, we're talking about the rediscovery of Louisa May Alcott as a literary author in the 21st century. This is Louisa as Legacy.
On a bitter Tuesday morning in March, Anna Alcott stood in Sleepy Hollow Cemetery in Concord, Massachusetts. She knew this place too well. She had stood in this very spot just 2 days before, saying goodbye to her father among his esteemed colleagues and friends. The dirt over his grave was still fresh. Now, it was time to say goodbye to Louisa, who had died only 2 days after him. Only close friends and family were there, according to Louisa's wishes for a simple service. Several lifelong friends paid tribute, and poems were spoken over her coffin. The sonnet, Duty's Faithful Child, that Bronson had once written for her, and one titled Transfiguration, that Louisa herself had penned after her mother's death, with lines that read, "But ere the sense of loss our hearts had wrung, a miracle was wrought, and swift as happy thought, she lived again. Brave, beautiful, and young." But for Anna, Louisa was gone, and with her, the family of her childhood. Anna had lost her husband years before, but her two sons were with her, as was her youngest sister May's child, whom they called Lulu. Lulu was born in France, but came to live with the Alcotts 8 years before. She was 9 now, and Anna was in her mid-50s. She knew the girl would now go back to live with her father in Switzerland, and the thought of losing more family was difficult to bear. For 2 decades, Louisa's health had suffered. Her later journals detail her attempts at recovery, her hopes on her good days, and her despair on her hardest ones. "Poorly," she journaled on July 20th, 1887. "Shut in on all sides by infirmities. Small dark world to live in after so much freedom and strength all these years. Ah, me." In 1887, at the age of 54, she spent the last year of her life in a respite home, trying homeopathic remedies for her many ills. She had left her beautiful mansion on the coveted Louisburg Square in Boston in order to find some calm and healing, but the doctor, Rhoda Lawrence, did not deliver the cure she needed. Louisa believed her health issues stemmed from mercury poisoning contracted during her illness as a Civil War nurse. But her obituary in the New York Times cited spinal meningitis. In the years since her death, scholars have posited other possibilities. In the introduction to Louisa's letters, biographer Madeline Stern offered that perhaps Louisa was dying from intestinal cancer. Others have proposed a diagnosis of lupus or other autoimmune disorders. Whatever the cause, Louisa was essentially an invalid, barely able to write for an hour a day. She longed for the health and vitality of her youth, when she had so loved to run. But the end of her life found her exhausted and spent. Her years of toil had taken their toll. She was no longer the vibrant Jo March of her stories. Jo was just a character in a book. Louisa was a woman, and at age 55, she looked like a woman of 70. Louisa, fearing the end was near, had made her plans. In June 1887, 9 months before her death, she prepared her estate for her two nephews and her niece, adopting Anna's younger son, Johnny, and writing instructions for renewing her copyrights so Johnny could continue to manage her legacy for years to come. "What a funny muddle a little money makes," she wrote to her publisher, Thomas Niles. To Johnny, she advised him to change his name after the adoption went through, writing, "If I pop off before it's done, you lose your copyrights, as you are not my heir, till the Alcott is tagged on to the string, which makes John a kite with a long tail." When Louisa May Alcott died on March 8, 1888, she was a beloved celebrity author of children's stories. She was one of the richest and most popular writers of her day, her name synonymous with children's literature. In the introduction to Little Women Abroad, Alcott scholar Daniel Sheeley writes, "During the years 1868 to 1886, She earned, on book publications only, royalties of approximately $103,375, equivalent to over $2.25 million today. This did not include payments for poetry, stories, serials, or European editions of her works. Louisa achieved the success of her wildest dreams. The money required an enormous amount of attention and management. Her writings, everything from her letters to her published works, would always be in demand.
In 1883, 5 years before Louisa's death, another children's author had arrived in Concord. Her name was Harriet Lothrop, though she wrote under the pen name Margaret Sidney. Lothrop and her husband, Daniel, owned a publishing company together, and Lothrop wrote the popular Pepper novels, such as The Five Little Peppers and How They Grew, first published in 1881. 2 years later, the couple purchased the Wayside House, previously owned by both the Alcotts and the Hawthorns. They were no strangers to literary history, and they wanted to preserve the house and its legacy for future generations. Next door to the Wayside House was the Brown House, Orchard House, where the Alcotts had lived for nearly 20 years, from 1858 to 1877. The Alcotts sold the house to William Torrey Harris, an educator who had taken a deep interest in Bronson Alcott's career and teachings. Harris eventually became the U.S. Commissioner of Education, serving under four different U.S. presidents. He is credited with founding the first permanent public kindergarten in America, following the legacy of Elizabeth Palmer Peabody, who was one of Bronson Alcott's first assistants in his schools. A generation later, the world was finally ready for Bronson's ideas about education. They were welcomed readily when presented by William Torrey Harris. But Harris didn't live at the Orchard House, and by 1900, the old house was falling into disrepair. This didn't stop the hordes of tourists who walked up the lawn to peek in the windows. Harriet Lothrop could see that interest in Louisa May Alcott's life and work had not faded in the 12 years since her death. Lothrop purchased the Orchard House from William Torrey Harris in 1900 for the sale price of $1. Along with the Women's Club of Concord, Harriet Lothrop raised funds to open Orchard House as a museum. It opened to the public in 1911. The Women's Club became the Louisa May Alcott Memorial Association, which owns and operates the museum today. Anna's sons, Fred and John, donated much of the original furniture, artwork, and belongings to the museum. The Women's Club used photographs of the family in and around the house to place items where they had been in the Alcott's time. Visitation was consistent, proving Louisa's fame. Louisa had been a private person. Now the doors of her home were flung open to any paying member of the public. On one end of the horsehair sofa at Orchard House, there is Louisa's original mood pillow, which is referenced in Little Women. An oblong pillow of orange velvet, the legend says that when Louisa was in a good mood and accepting visitors, she propped the pillow upright. But when she was in her vortex or not feeling well, she would lie the pillow on its side, and that meant to give her space. Visitors could peek through the front windows of the living room to read Louisa's emotional state on her mood pillow before choosing whether to knock on the door. While it's a quaint example, what the mood pillow really stands for is Louisa's desire for privacy without having to ask for it. People began to feel entitled to Louisa's life as though she was obligated to welcome and entertain them. They felt so at home in the pages of her books. They could not imagine that the author's home was not as comfortable a place to settle in. But Louisa valued her solitude, and there is a certain irony to the way people have flocked to her since her books became so popular. Orchard House is not the only one of Louisa's homes to have become a museum. In 1914, the Red Farmhouse at Fruitlands also opened to the public, purchased by art collector Clara Endicott Sears as a place to preserve the history of the Transcendentalist movement. Visitors can still see the rooms where Louisa and her family faced some of their darkest days, where Louisa took cold water baths and ate bread and water in the terribly cold winter of 1845. Fruitland still stands as a testimony to the cost of an idea. There are also many plaques dedicated to Louisa May Alcott throughout the eastern United States. At the place of her birth in Germantown, Pennsylvania, and at her former home on Pinckney Street in Beacon Hill, Even the marker in Spindle Hill, Connecticut, that commemorates the birthplace of Bronson Alcott, mentions Louisa's name in font as large as his own.
Louisa's life has been of interest to scholars and the public since before her death. In 1884, she was featured in Louise Chandler Moulton's book called Our Famous Women, The Lives and Deeds of Distinguished American Women of Our Time. Because Louisa was still alive and busily writing, Moulton said, "We are too near at hand for perspective, and too much under the spell of a sympathetic personality to be able to anticipate the judgments of posterity. The piece would instead gratify the general curiosity about a general favorite." Louisa herself crafted a short autobiographical story of her childhood in 1888, right before her death, which was published posthumously. The amusing anecdotes and detailed stories provide us with a welcome image of Louisa as a child, tramping over hill and dale and plucking chicken feathers to decorate hats for dolls. In these few pages, Louisa tells stories we otherwise would not know, but the picture it paints leaves out the many challenges a young Louisa had lived and sorrowed through. In 1888, the year of Louisa's death, Edna Dow Cheney published the first official biography of Louisa, called Louisa May Alcott, The Children's Friend, as well as a heavily edited collection of Louisa's journals and letters. Both books painted a picture of Louisa, minus the rough edges, as the genteel spinster Aunt Jo, an image Louisa herself had created in her book Aunt Jo's Scrap Bag, according to Harriet Reason in her biography, The Woman Behind Little Women. Cheney's biography, which left out key facts about the more difficult aspects of Louisa's life and the depth of her writings, fed into the growing myth of Louisa May Alcott as simply the children's friend. It's not that Louisa wasn't a friend to children. She certainly made her living by telling entertaining, lively, and realistic stories to a young audience. It's that she was so much more than the children's friend. The books for which she was best known, Little Women, Old Fashioned Girl, Little Men, were a small part of her body of work. But at the time Cheney wrote her biography, the world had yet to know of more.
In 1929, two women crossed paths in New York City for the first time. Their names were Madeline Stern and Leona Rostenberg. According to the New York Times, they regarded each other with mutual disdain. Miss Stern was a lowly college freshman, and Miss Rostenberg, a senior at New York University, was not Ivy League. Then they met again as graduate students at Columbia. They embarked together on a life of research and scholarship that changed how Louisa May Alcott was read and understood. Through literary sleuthing, they discovered that Louisa May Alcott had written under pen names and that the potboilers produced by Jo March in Little Women may have been more than fiction. Leona Rostenberg describes the deafening silence of Houghton Library at Harvard in the 1940s when she went to learn more about Louisa's pseudonym. While reading some letters from a publication entitled Flag of Our Union, she describes, "I immediately felt cold and hot and strangely faint. She was on the path to discovering Louisa's secret nearly a century later. When she found the name A.M. Barnard, she writes, my wild war whoop shattered the heavy silence of the manuscript room of Houghton Library. Rostenberg was not immediately allowed to read the Flag of Our Union, which was in safekeeping for the duration of World War II. But soon, Madeline Stern was offered a Guggenheim Fellowship to write a biography of Louisa May Alcott, and she gained access to what was previously kept hidden. Her biography was published in 1950 and is still considered a definitive explanation of Louisa's life. Stern and Rostenberg continued to compile lists of Louisa's thrillers. They eventually published a collection called Behind a Mask, The Unknown Thrillers of Louisa May Alcott in 1975, which included several of the dark and twisted tales Louisa wrote before she made her fortune with Little Women. This was followed by other collections of Louisa's thrillers, as well as articles and books of literary criticism and analysis on Louisa's new, complex literary image. Rostenberg referred to herself as the little grandmother of the Alcott Revolution, And indeed, the discovery of the thrillers was a paradigm shift for the way we read Louisa May Alcott's works. Uncovering this darker, more lurid side to Louisa helped give depth to the saccharine lightness of her juvenile fiction, broadening her reputation during this period. The first two collections of thrillers were published during the second wave feminism movement of the 1960s and 1970s, a time ripe for reassessment of an author whose Little Women had begun to be rejected by the feminists of the day, with its perfectly disgusting, banal, and craven service to male supremacy, as discussed in Stephanie Harrington's 1973 article, Does Little Women Belittle Women? Enter the thrillers and the flurry of scholarship that followed. In the 1979 essay, Little Women, Alcott's Civil War, Judith Federley writes, "The work of Stern in identifying and recovering Alcott's sensation fiction provides an important context for the reading of Little Women and for an understanding of the implications of its style." Even today, The Four Sisters and their creative, welcoming home draws readers into a world that is familiar and comforting. It also challenges us with relevant and timely questions, as Anne Boyd Rue explores in her book, Meg, Jo, Beth, Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters. Questions about female independence and fulfillment, questions about what constitutes female literature, and deep feelings of identification can all be pulled from the text 150 years later. Far from straightforward, the book is contradictory in its themes and messages, continuing to spark debate over its relevance today. Opinions run strong over how Little Women reflects and doesn't reflect our modern perspective and ideals, a mark of truly great literature. The thrillers and the publication in the 1990s of more of Louisa's earlier works, such as A Long Fatal Love Chase and The Inheritance, paved the way for these new debates and interpretations of Louisa's life and her works. The thrillers proved that Louisa, as Stern wrote in 1985, was a more complex human being and a more adventurous writer than had once been supposed. In the 1980s and 1990s, Madeline Stern, Joel Meyerson, and Daniel Sheely edited and published Louisa May Alcott's letters and journals. These two collections gave both scholars and fans precious insight and entry into Louisa's mind and experiences. Yet there are still unanswered questions and unknown details that can only be found in her original papers. Many of these originals, however, were burned by Louisa herself in later years as she carefully curated what could be accessed by the future. Knowing the extent of her fame, Louisa was aware of the possibility that her papers would be read by others. She feared gossip more than anything, so she destroyed many of her writings, as well as her mother's journals and letters, since they contained details about her marriage that Louisa did not feel was for public consumption. She had known the way the celebrity machine worked, and she was correct. Her journals and papers live in the Houghton Library at Harvard, where they are accessible to researchers with any interest in the Alcotts whatsoever, while her edited journals and letters sit on shelves across the world. It would most likely have shocked Louisa to know her private thoughts and correspondence would be dissected again and again for insight into her psychology.
Louisa's fame for the writing of Little Women has hardly wavered in the past 150 years, as the book's influence has spread from the page to the screen. The first two film adaptations of the book arrived in 1917 and 1918. Then, in 1933, Katharine Hepburn starred as Jo in the first full-length version with sound. Another version in 1949 starred June Allison and used the same script as the Hepburn film. Since then, there has been a film version of Little Women made for each generation. And when the book gets remade and rediscovered through film, Louisa's works attract more attention. Visitation at her museums increases. She once again is launched into the forefront of the public imagination. And with each adaptation, her legacy changes slightly. In the 1994 movie version of Little Women, for example, the script contained references to Abigail Alcott's philanthropic works. In the 2019 version, directed by Greta Gerwig, Gerwig framed the whole story from Jo's publisher's office, blending the lines between fact and fiction changing the way we see Jo and her story. These changes represent the changing values between generations of viewers. Nowhere is this more evident than in the scene where Jo turns down Lori's proposal. In the earlier movie versions, Jo and Lori have a long talk beneath a tree. Jo cries and apologizes for not loving Lori. She breaks both of their hearts, and it is unfathomable to the viewer that Jo might not love someone who is so obviously marriageable. As feminism has evolved, so has the Jo-Lori dynamic. Jo has gained strength in these scenes over time. In the 1994 movie version, we see a young Christian Bale forcefully kiss Jo while the two are standing at a fence, a scene that many viewers have found uncomfortable to watch. And in the 2018 PBS Masterpiece version, Jo and Lori walk and talk together rather than staying still. Lori is becoming the more emotive character, begging for Jo's hand. Finally, Timothée Chalamet brought his signature emotional embodiment to the 2019 version, with a physicality that hadn't been seen before in other versions. He cries, tosses his hair, and shouts at Jo, spittle flying from his mouth. He is the one who is desperate for her. The evolution of this rejection shows that modern viewers are able to relate to Jo's right to choose her husband, rather than with her disappointment at not being the one. Little Women continues to resonate with readers and artists. As Rue argues, just as Hemingway claimed that all of American literature, by men, came from Huck Finn, we can also say that much of American women's literature has come from Little Women. Famous authors across the world cite Jo March as their literary inspiration, including Simone de Beauvoir, Susan Sontag, Zadie Smith, Barbara Kingsolver, Jhumpa Lahiri, Doris Lessing, and Patti Smith. By giving personalities and agency to young women in her novel, Louisa May Alcott effectively gave agency to generations of artists and writers, allowing women to see in the mirror of Little Women their own creative potential. A less well-known, but no less important example, is Maggie Lukens. In December 1883, or January 1884, a young woman in Pennsylvania named Maggie sent a letter in the post east to Massachusetts, to the home of famous author Louisa May Alcott. This wasn't the first time Maggie had written to Louisa. In 1871, 13 years before, Maggie and her four sisters, ranging in age from 17 to 9, had started on a literary endeavor inspired by their favorite book, Little Women. Motherless and living with their father in the small town of Brinton, Pennsylvania, the sisters had the idea of creating their own newspaper based on the Pickwick portfolio in Little Women to pass the time and practice their writing skills. They called their paper Little Things. Within 2 years, the handwritten family newspaper had grown to 1,000 subscribers. The girls, savvy marketers even at a young age, reached out to famous authors to ask them to subscribe and endorse the paper. One of the writers they contacted was Louisa May Alcott herself, who responded with enthusiasm. "I admire your pluck and perseverance and heartily believe in women's right to any branch of labor for which they prove their fitness," she wrote. Not only did she subscribe to their paper, but the correspondence continued. Four letters made their way from Orchard House to Pennsylvania between 1871 and 1874. Louisa's letters were short but kind, as she was obviously impressed with the girls' entrepreneurship and creative independence. "I like to help women help themselves," she once said to them. The Lukenses kept the newspaper going until 1874, when they were able to sell it to another children's periodical. In the last letter Louisa sent them in the 1870s, she agreed that, "Though I was sorry to lose the little sheet, I think you were wise to give it up." That was the last surviving correspondence between them for 10 years, until Maggie wrote to Louisa again in 1884. Six letters passed from Massachusetts to Pennsylvania in the next 3 years. Maggie's letters don't survive, but Louisa's are intimate, raw, and vulnerable, sharing personal sorrows and her beliefs on death, women's rights, and spirituality. Alcott scholar Daniel Sheeley calls them the most philosophical and personal of Alcott's extant letters. As we explored in episode 6, Louisa as Celebrity, Louisa was not comfortable with fame or interested in promoting herself. She grew irritated with the nosiness of autograph seekers and hated to get her photograph taken. In her surviving letters, there is no evidence of any long-lasting correspondence between Louisa and any of her fans. except for Maggie and her sisters, who connected with Louisa and her books and reached out to her in a way we can only dream of doing. In researching the Lucan sisters and the story behind these letters, I was struck by the impact of Louisa's legacy, not just in its far-reaching influence on society or American literature, but also in how it has been experienced on a personal, individual level, unique to each of us. That was true for Maggie Lucan's, as it has been true for countless others, including myself. Would I have seen myself in the books I read without the driven, creative female archetype that Jo March led to? How would I view my experiences as a woman without Louisa's example? How would my creative path look different without Louisa's presence? These are questions that I return to, but I'm never sure that I want to know the answer.
When she was 15, a young and determined Louisa had told the universe, "I will do something by and by. Don't care what. Teach, sew, act, write, anything to help the family. And I'll be rich and famous and happy before I die." Her premonition, or perseverance, led her to more fame than she cared to have. After Louisa's death at 55, her youngest sister May's husband, Ernest Nieriker, came to visit his child, Lulu. Despite Anna's wishes, Nieriker insisted that Lulu be returned to him. The following year, Anna took the child to Switzerland, where she left Lulu in her father's care. Lulu lived in Switzerland for the duration of her life. She had one child and died at the age of 96 in 1975. Lulu's descendants are scattered throughout Europe now and own much of May Alcott's original artwork. Anna's boys remained in the Concord area. Due to changes in the U.S. copyright law, John Pratt Alcott eventually lost the ability to keep the copyrights for Little Women. Little Women and the rest of Louisa's juvenile fiction entered the public domain. Works published later on, such as the thrillers and letters, can be copyrighted by the family estate. Some of Anna's descendants still live nearby and engage with Orchard House as a way to promote Louisa's legacy. At first, that legacy was that of a children's author and the children's friend. As we know, Louisa's life could not be contained by these simplistic labels. She was larger than life, a feminist, a suffragette, an abolitionist. She was also a loving and devoted daughter and sister. She was a brilliant writer who could take whole lives and transform them into relatable stories for her readers. As we've attempted to show during the course of this podcast series, Louisa's influence and contribution to history extend beyond her most enduring novel. As a literary celebrity, she helped to move forward women's suffrage and advocated for women's independent careers and education. Her adult works pushed boundaries of her day and still give us considerable insight into the psyche of a 19th century woman. Her example as a writer and independent woman continues to inspire us. Stay tuned for our conversation. But first, in the spirit of the Alcott's beliefs in social justice, each week we are highlighting an organization we believe in and asking for your support. For this episode, we are supporting Elsewhere Studios. Elsewhere Studios is an artist residency program in Paonia, Colorado, and is an eclectic, imaginative space that values exploration and experimentation. You can find more information and links to donate in the show notes or on our website, letgeniusburn.com. So, Jill.
Hi, Jamie.
It's a week before this podcast is supposed to be out.
We are finally recording it. Jamie, this is our last one for now.
I know. Well, we procrastinated working on it, I think, because we were sad it was going to be over.
Yeah, we definitely did procrastinate on this one. I think it was just hard to end it, you know?
Well, and it's like all the sad stuff, you know, it starts with a funeral. And we had kind of said that we were going to start with Louisa's death and go, you know, from there. And truly, like, the thing we both love is talking about Louisa. And then she's just kind of absent from this whole, you know, section because she dies at the beginning of the essay. So,
right.
I think she would have really disliked this whole part where we just talk about everyone who's invaded her diaries and her house and everything.
I don't know. I think 15-year-old Louisa would have been pretty cool with it. She would have been like, ooh, that all happened? Cool. Later, Louisa may have been frustrated. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Louisa, like when I want to talk about Louisa, I want to talk about what she did and what she thought and what she was up to, because there's just so many things to talk about that we've not, haven't even touched on in all of these episodes. There's still so many things, so many stories. And so when that's kind of missing, it's harder to get into.
Well, I think one of the things that we haven't really talked about yet, and that is included in the essay, and that is endlessly fascinating to me, is the interpretations of Little Women over time. Mm-hmm. Like that part about the breakup scene between Joe and Laurie. It's not really a breakup, but, you know, the rejection, we'll call mm-hmm. it.
Right.
And how that scene evolves. Like, watch Joe. I highly recommend this to all of our listeners. Go ahead and watch Joe break Laurie's heart in all the movie versions of Little Women in a row. Like, just go to that part and watch it happen. And it is amazing how it evolves over time. And I think it is a reflection of feminist values. I think it's a reflection of, you know, what's happening in our sensibility about gender. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really evident in two places in the movie versions. One is Marmee. That was mentioned in the episode that, like, Marmee gets to be more of a character. She gets just, like, more outside interests besides, like, taking care of Mr. March. Mm-hmm. And then Amy. Amy's my favorite. So I think about this one all the time. But, like, to watch Amy go from just snotty, bratty little sister to, like, full-blown foil to Joe, is a real character, is a real person with multifaceted person. I think that that is actually a feminist point of view, because it's not the misogynist, Amy is conventional woman, therefore she is bad mm-hmm. point of view.
Well, and that's what I really like about, so I'm not really a purist when it comes to any adaptations. I was like this with Harry Potter. I'm like this with Little Women, like anything I watch. I'm not a purist. I want to see how it's interpreted. And I just really find it fascinating how that interpretation changes over time. And with Little Women, we can see that because there are so many versions available. So you can kind of see that progression in a way that you can't maybe with other adaptations. They're time capsules of their time and of how they're going to be interpreted based on the time that they're made. And then you can see that, how that plays out with Little Women over these many, many decades. And so I think that's fascinating. I know so many people want things to, you know, follow the book exactly, but I really love, I mean, isn't this the whole reason that we read and engage with literature, is because we have new lenses with which to view them, and it's going to be colored by what we experience and what our own cultural environment. So the movies reflect that brilliantly, and that's what's so fun about it. And so I've just never been one of those people that sit there and go, that's missing, I don't like that. Like, I'm just not that person. I'm just more like, huh, I wonder why they chose to do it that way. That's so interesting, because I feel like that's engaging with it so much more on such a deeper level than just watching the book on the screen. You know, that's not what I'm looking for.
Well, and there's no way to watch the book on the screen, because we all have our own
right
movie version that takes place in our heads when we read.
And it would be seven hours long. Little Women's a big book, man. Take forever.
At least 7 hours long. You know, I'm thinking of when people started to learn more about the 2019 version, and they were getting critical about how it was so white and saying, you know, Laurie is a perfect example. He could have been played by a person of color. There's no reason why, you know, it had to be a white actor. But, you know, those kinds of choices, those kinds of director's choices, they still define, like, the moment. And I do mm-hmm. hope that there will be a version of Little Women that will not be so white, even mm-hmm. though there was a lot of pushback I saw on the internet kind of say. And that's the way it really was. It's like,
but we have the freedom to interpret it and reinterpret it. That's the whole point.
And what do we even know about what it really was, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's a new book coming out. So Many Beginnings, I think it's called. It's like a Little Women remix. And it's where all the sisters, it takes place at the same time period. So it's not one of those books that kind of puts it forward in time, but it's in the same time period. But it's a Black family, which I think I'm really excited. It comes out in September. I'm excited to read that because I just, those are the types of reinterpretations of something. You know, there's only so many times you can tell a story, maybe, or maybe not. You can tell a story in a lot of different ways, but yeah, let's see. This is such a timeless, universal story and family that it can be interpreted and reinterpreted for other cultures and places and ethnicities. And I think, and it has, and I know that there's new adaptation, you know, rewrites of Jane Austen books that are very similar too. And I think, again, that, like we said in the episode, that's the mark of good literature, is if it's a central universal story that can then be applied to lots of different perspectives. And that's what we should be doing. That's what how we should be engaging with the book.
I think it only helps Louisa's legacy, right? For it to reach a broader audience. I have used this analogy before, but when Ryan Adams remade the entire 1989 album by Taylor Swift, he did say that he sandblasted these songs and he knew that they had good bones because they could be sandblasted and they still held up. And that was like the mark of good songwriting. And I think about that with Little Women actually quite a lot, because I think Little Women has those good bones and that good structure where then there can be myriad interpretations and evolutions that really only benefit Louisa's legacy. Okay, yes, at first, Ryan Adams was getting reviewed in Spin and places where Taylor wasn't getting reviewed. And that was like a bit of an uproar saying, hey, these like more prestigious or more indie outlets are going to review a cover of an entire album by Taylor without crediting her, really, without ever having reviewed her. It's sort of a similar thing. Like, oh, these people are going to remake Little Women. They really only help to like lift it up and boost it up. I mean, Greta Gerwig, she is brilliant and revered as a director, I think, anyway. And I think that it was great that she chose Little Women as a project. I think that only helps to, you know, elevate it and helps Louisa's legacy. I would love to see it, Little Women, getting sandblasted and remade with even more different contexts, even broader audiences that it can reach and people that it can touch.
Agreed. Yeah, I completely agree. And I hope that that continues to happen.
Because I always monologue.
No, I love that analogy about like how it just has the bones and the structure, because I mean, I love Louisa deeply. Little Women is not my favorite book. It's just not. There are parts in it that I don't like or that just doesn't read well anymore to my mind. And I know I'm not the only one who thinks that, but like you're saying, the bones and the structure are there. The story itself, the way that she wrote it, that was just completely revolutionary. And so that is continuing to trickle down. We are continued to be drawn to it, even if the language is a little stilted, or even if we don't really quite agree with some of the moralizing or whatever, just whatever perspective we're coming from, it still has this core piece of it that Louisa created that is so universal that we can't get away from it. We're still drawn to it. We still crave it. And I think that's brilliant. And that's why I think she is a genius.
I agree. I mean, I think that's kind of the whole point, is like, there are certain story structures that, you know, really hold up. I feel like my classic go-to when a kid is like, tell me a story, is it quickly becomes Wizard of Oz. They're on a journey and then they like meet a friend and then they meet a friend, you know, like add to the group. And I think Little Women has that. It has like built in this idea of these different personality types, so they face different trials And it's just like so brilliant that each one is relatable, almost like at different phases of your life. Like we're all going to go through, you know, your phase where you relate to Meg.
Meg and Joe. Yeah.
Someone said that to me when I was working at Orchard House one time. Like I've reread Little Women every 10 years, and every 10 years I relate completely with a totally different character.
Oh, that's so cool.
She said, you know, I read it when I was a kid and like looking up to them. And then I read it when I was kind of their age. And then as an adult and like looking back, and now I'm getting to the point where like I'm, you know, reading it more as like Marmee.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, it's so interesting.
That is so interesting. I haven't reread it in quite a few years. So I'm going to have to do that and see who I identify with or where I'm at. I haven't read it since becoming a mother. So I am kind of interested to see if that would change my perspective.
That would be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I think that scene in the 2018 masterpiece version when Emily Watson sees the four daughters getting ready for the wedding. Ugh. I just cry at that part every time. So good.
She's so good.
She's the best.
I feel like we've said this before, but oh my God, she's the best Marmee.
We said it like on an Instagram.
Did we? Okay, so it's not officially in the podcast. Now it is. Emily Watson's the best Marmee, we've said.
The best Marmee of all time.
If you haven't watched the 2018 PBS version, please go watch it just so that you can watch Emily Watson and cry. Because she nails it. She nails it.
She is not only Marmee to me, but Abigail Alcott. Like,
I agree.
So that's exactly how I picture Abigail.
I absolutely agree.
Like, a bit stoic, but like super soft and mushy on the inside. Mm-hmm. Oh, just gets me.
Yeah, I love it. My favorite scene in that one is when the girls are getting out the door for school and work, and they're, Marmee, where's my boots? And like, they're just, you know, they're being typical, like young adults late for work. And she's sitting at the desk, like writing a letter or a bill or something. And she's like, if you do not get out of this house in 5 minutes, it's fabulous, because it's like, oh yeah, this is so relatable.
It's amazing. I sound how like that in the came morning. Out just like a year before the Gerwig. They have a lot of similarities, I think, in terms of like trying to make it seem less like stilted, formal, the way we imagine people were in the 19th century, but the way they probably were not.
Right.
Like they probably were just, you know,
especially
kind of the
not
way
at
we are
home.
Now. Both of those versions, I think, really take that head on and do a good job. There is a small book of essays that came out around the time of the movie, I think like capitalizing on the success of the movie or helping to promote the movie. But one of the essays is by Jane Smiley, and Jane Smiley, obviously, brilliant Pulitzer Prize winning author. But she writes, Joe and Amy constitute two types of feminists we will see in the future who will agree on some matters and disagree on others. Joe is the one who values her independence and wishes to retain it, even if it leads to disagreement or unhappiness. Amy is the one who thinks that the best option for doing what she wants is to learn to navigate and make use of the world she is stuck with. We might think of Joe as the agitator and Amy as the political operative. And I love this essay so much because, you know, I'm such a big Amy fan, and I have always like thought that Amy was a feminist, and I like really wanted to say this, but I didn't know how to articulate it. And this essay, which is called I Am Your Prudent Amy, and it's in this book, March Sisters on Life, Death, and Little Women, it really articulated the way that I saw Amy as a feminist. And I just thought, you know, isn't it amazing that Louisa, in the creation of Little Women, like knew that Joe had to have a foil. Maybe she knew that instinctively, you know, like there has to be tension here for the story to be propelled forward. But that as we evolve in our understanding of feminism, then we get to see the ways that both of them are kind of like deliberately undermining the patriarchy in two different approaches.
Yeah.
So cool.
Yeah.
I really think it's so cool how we can kind of like follow the progression of Alcott scholarship as a way to like understand like the deepening of our respect for Louisa's work as literary.
Mm-hmm.
And we're at a point now, Madeline Stern and Leon Rosenberg in the 40s and 50s doing all this really cool primary source research. We're at a point now where researchers can go and look at their research and kind of like do this like meta analysis. And same right. with Madeline Bedell, which we didn't talk about this in the podcast, although we have referenced Alcott's Biography of a mm-hmm. Family quite a bit. But Madeline Bedell wrote Alcott's Biography of a Family Part 1. It ends 1857, something like that.
Something like that.
1858, maybe. Basically, she went to Orchard House. This is all hearsay, but she went to Orchard House and said, wait till you read the second half. You won't believe all these things I found out. And so much interesting stuff. And I believe it because Alcott's Biography of a Family is an awesome biography. It covers all these things that other biographers don't talk about. Like, did the Alcotts use birth control? And like a lot of the stuff about like Fruitlands and the philosophy about should we stay married or split up or what. Mm-hmm. Like, she did such an interesting job of talking about all that. She talks about Abigail's social work in such a dynamic way, looking at, you know, the roles of women, all this cool stuff. Well, anyways, she said that she was writing the second half and then she died and there is no second volume. And it has for years been like, oh, her research is at Orchard House. Someone should be working on this. Fascinating. Her research was so detailed.
It's such a loss that we didn't get that second volume.
Sometimes I'll be researching and I'll think like, I wonder what Bedell had to say about, you know, Louisa as a nurse or something. And it's like, oh yeah, we never got that. That's such a shame.
It is such a shame. Mm. That is one of the only biographies I've never read. I need to. It's on my
list. I'll bring you my copy when I come.
Oh, I have a copy. Oh. I have a copy. I picked it up at a used book sale once. I just haven't gotten to it yet. Isn't that terrible?
Oh, it's so good.
It's on my shelf. It's so good. I've skimmed it. I mean, like I've used it for research, but I haven't just like sat down and read it. But I plan to.
There are some works of fiction that impact her legacy. For example, the book March by Geraldine Brooks.
So good.
It's such a great novel. It won the Pulitzer. It is about Mr. March. So the fictional character of Mr. March going to the South. And it is an imaginary version about an imaginary character. And yet you would get people coming to Orchard House all the time who were just like, that Bronson Alcott sleeping around in the South.
Oh my gosh.
And really worked up about it. And I was just like, that's a novel about a novel. That is not about Bronson. Bronson did go to the South. It was before he was married. This is total speculation. Like, we really don't know. You know, certain things like that that get read, they do still have an impact on Louisa's overall legacy. Mm-hmm. There is a book called Alternative Alcott and the introductions by Elaine Showalter. That introduction's got to be 30 years old. It's so good. It's still so relevant. I reread that all the time. I love that one.
Nice. I return to the primary sources again and again. Like, if I could choose to read a biography or read her journal, I'd choose her journals. So I love those. And I just have like pieces underlined. And I found a letter the other day. I was just looking through it. And I found one that she wrote to Anna just about like something about just how wonderful Anna is and how much she loves her or something. And I had, in a previous time, I had underlined it and then put my sister's name in the margin. I put Jenny.
Aww,
and so I sent her a picture. I was like, I don't remember doing this, but
yeah, I guess I love you.
I love you. Look at this. I have found like notes from my dad that I saved and stuck in it. Like, I found so many things stuck in my copies of the journals and letters. It's almost rereading them now is really fun to see what my notes were and like little things I had in there because I've just gone through them so many times. It's just kind of almost starting to become a little bit of a scrapbook almost of my own journey of learning and interacting with Louisa. So that's kind of fun. It's fun to see
really
what
cool,
spoke
yeah.
to me. Yeah. Yeah. So that's been fun. But the other kind of biography, kind of, it's more literary criticism. kind of the one that I've really come back to is From Blood and Thunder to Hearth and Home by Madeline Stern, which is actually a collection of essays that she and Leona Rostenberg wrote between the 40s and the 90s. So this whole span of time, she's kind of collected them all into this one volume. And that's mostly about the discovery of the thrillers and then an analysis of the thrillers. She's got some essays that are specifically about just one work, like Behind a Mask, or Jamie's Wonder Book, which was Louisa's lost story about Jamie's Wonder Book, which I love. We both feature in Louisa's books, in some of Louisa's stories, right? Because there's Jack and Jill, and there's Jamie's Wonder Book. So this is super nerdy of me, but I love the idea that Louisa wrote our names at one point in the past.
Like with her pen?
With her pen, yeah. With her crippled thumb.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
Yeah, that's a fabulous collection of essays. If anyone's interested in learning more about the thrillers and kind of getting, it just provides such a great insight into her development as a writer. And Stern's whole thesis is that Louisa was this professional, and she kind of takes this arc of her, you know, professional life and how she developed as a writer and how she learned really the craft and how she did that through her works. It's really interesting. It's really good.
I've heard people talk about the ways that, like, Orchard House has at different times under different leadership had different focuses. And, like, you know, there was this director, Jane Gordon, who now leads, like, the Concord History class and is the director of Massachusetts Historical Society. And she was much more, like, education focused, and that there was, like, this big, like, focus on, like, the legacy of Bronson Alcott as an educator. And she was an educator and, like, wanted to, like, reach more teachers and so on. And with Jan, the focus has always been on growing funding to, like, get the message out more about Orchard House. And so, you know, that is a piece that is, like, sort of part, I think, of the legacy of the Alcotts, is, like, whoever has these positions of leadership over some of these organizations kind of gets to steer the ship a little bit in terms of what we learn about or appreciate or emphasize within Louisa's body of work or within the different themes of the Alcott's lives.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's historical sites. That's what they do. They interpret. You know, I think there was something that Fruitlands did this past spring. Maybe it's still up, but it's like an art installation of someone created art that's hung around the house. And I want to say it's like fabric, like it's sewn or something. And it's hung all around the farmhouse. And it's of Louisa's childhood quotes sewed into things. And it's beautiful. I'm like, I teared up when I saw it, like on Instagram, they posted it. And just, you know, that just like an art piece of her words as it hung in the same rooms that she would have written it, you know, during like the most difficult year of her life. And I thought that was beautiful. Like, what a beautiful way of taking this really difficult time in her life and taking this pretty unknown piece of her biography and creating something really beautiful out of it at the site where it occurred. I mean, that is incredible, I think. So it is just really neat to see how different sites and different places will continue in a story and what things they tend to focus on. You know, I know at Orchard House right now, they focus on, like one of the things is they do a 5K because Louisa loved to run. And so they really like that's part of that story that they tell every year. So it's just really neat to see like what gets highlighted and what is passed along then to those who come and take that with them.
Right. The same way that the different media interpretations, right? The different movie versions and different years.
Yeah. And that just speaks so strongly to how deep Louisa's legacy is. And we may not have even recognized that, but when we see all of the different ways that she can be, that her life and her works can be interpreted and taught and passed along, I mean, that just speaks to how multidimensional she is.
I think that's why, you know, there are 8 essays in this podcast that are each for a different facet of her interests or personality, because there isn't just one story, you know. And Little Women is important. I think it's important because it does bring a lot of people kind of into the orbit. Then you know, getting to that next step where it's like, how do we move beyond Louisa's legacy of Little Women? How do we, mm-hmm. that was the life work of Madeline Stern and Leona Rosenberg, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it is an ongoing project.
Well, and then I think to take that and to apply it beyond Louisa, there's so many women in history who are only known for one thing, or if they're known at all. And so just taking that, like, look at all of these facets of this one historical figure and applying that to other people in history, other women or people of color or LGBTQ people whose stories are mostly marginalized or who haven't been passed down as much. You know, who else in history do we maybe only know one or two things about? What more is there to discover? What more can they teach us about our history, our lives, our culture?
Well, I tend to think that Louisa's life was exceptionally interesting. Mm-hmm. But I don't doubt that there are many others who could rival and whose stories have yet to be told and mm-hmm. whose stories, you know, need to be told as a way for us to understand, better understand ourselves, better understand our past, how we got here.
Is there a way that Louisa's helped you understand yourself?
Every way. I've said this before, but like Orchard House gave me a community, an intellectual community. It gave me a place to grow and learn.
For me, I just think Louisa May Alcott gives me, her example gives me permission to be myself. And I'm still discovering that as a 33-year-old. I'm still discovering who I am and who I want to be. But she kind of gives me that permission to do that when I read her journals and letters and see her own self-confidence. And it rubs off on me, I think, a little bit. Or I like to think that it does. I aspire to be like that, be more confident and love myself a little bit more and accept myself in the way that Louisa did.
Yeah. Louisa was undeniably herself, you know?
Mm-hmm. I know. I love that.
She did not make a lot of apologies for that.
No. One other thing that Louisa has given me and given us is that we are friends.
Each other. It's a beautiful
thing. Each other. We didn't know each other before this happened. And this whole process has been incredible. And I feel like we've just become really good friends because of it. So I think Louisa would love that. I think she'd love the fact that she brought us together.
I think so too. I mean, I think her support of the Lukens sisters, as you talked about in the episode, is pretty evident that she was all about, you know, like women supporting women and making those mm-hmm. kinds of connections. And yeah, our friendship is beautiful. We're so lucky we found each other because of Louisa.
I know. It's a beautiful thing.
Thank you for listening to Let Genius Burn. Our 8-part mini-series may be over, but stay tuned for bonus episodes, interviews with Louisa May Alcott scholars, and more conversations about everything from Victorian diet reform to the lost letters of Louisa. Plus, Jill and I will meet in person for the first time.
If you've enjoyed listening to Let Genius Burn this summer, please help us spread the word. Share it with your friends or take a minute to leave a review in Apple Podcasts. Reviews help others find Let Genius Burn. Don't forget to check out and donate, if you're able, to Elsewhere Studios this week. You can find information and links to donate in the show notes or on our website.
Follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Let Genius Burn, or find us on our website, letgeniusburn.com.